Welcome to The Reserve, a news and thoughts podcast from the Central Verse. I'm your host, Caleb Nygaard, and today is episode number 48. Very excited for today's episode. Stephen Kelly is back on with me today. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, Caleb.
And the guest of honor, Gina Smilek, Fed beat reporter for the New York Times and author of Limitless, which listeners have already read. Gina, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I mean that quite literally. I think of all of the appearances that you've done, and I know you've done a lot. In fact, I've been to a couple of them. This audience may just be the highest percentage of people that have read the book. So I'm instead of giving the normal plug that, hey, people should go out and buy the book, I'm going to say that if by chance you haven't read it yet and you don't know this already, this book is perfect not only for listeners of The Reserve, which is obvious, but also for your parents and your grandparents and your siblings and coworkers. Like, that's the sweet spot of this book. That's really impressive, is that it hits. That's what I gave my parents. Mother's Day coming up. it was, I guess, a predictable book coming from me, but it was one meant truly. So congratulations first off on the big publication.
Thank you. That's very sweet of you. Yeah. And if people want to review it on Amazon, even if you've already bought it, you can do that. I'm constantly trying to like plug the reviews now.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. That's where it's at. Okay. You got, you've got at least a dozen from the 13 listeners of the show today that are going to be doing this. That's a big deal. I wanted to start actually by asking just a question about the book itself. There is a great amount of history and current events, pandemic story, what happened leading up to the pandemic, how the big shift of the Fed happened in the last 5 years for sure, and 10 years more broadly. But how did, as you were doing the history research, you know, what were some things that stood out to you as most important that you learned that you didn't know going in? And then also, is there anything that, since most people literally will have already read the book, are there any fun things that didn't able to make the final cut?
Well, Caleb, you read an early version of the history section of this book, so you know that like half of it ended up on the cutting room floor. So yeah, that there was lots to make the cut. But I think big takeaway when I was doing the history research on this book, which I will say I came at it from like a sort of semi-familiar point of view. Like, I've been covering the Fed for a long time. By the time I started researching this book, I was like 5 or 6 years into covering it. And so it wasn't like I was coming at this completely cold, but I also hadn't, you know, I'm not a historian. I hadn't done a lot of historical research on the Fed. I just kind of like, you know, picked up by osmosis what you pick up by osmosis on the beat. Yeah, exactly. Yep. I read the books. Yep. And so I think the thing that really surprised me that I hadn't really caught when I was reading books about the Fed, but which I caught when I was going back and doing more original research, reading like letters and newspaper articles from the time, is just how big a piece of the popular conversation money reform and then the early Federal Reserve was basically between like 1750 and 1913. Like, it was just like omnipresent. Like, it was in the paper all the time. Like, if you use the New York Times archives from those early 1900 years, like, this was talked about all the time. And I just find that so interesting, because I think we've created this almost like mythology of the Fed in the modern era, where we act like only a very specialist crowd can talk about it or should talk about it or is, you know, educated enough to talk about. And it's not like the Fed has actually gotten vastly more complicated since 1913. It's just like the level of public attention to these topics has really shifted quite a lot.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that is absolutely the case. And there's the story of central banking, like, is always told with like two sentences, is normally told as like two sentences. First central bank of Hamilton was Hamilton's. Andrew Jackson killed the second. There was nothing until 1907. JP Morgan saved the country. And then 1913 Fed happened. Like, there's that whole in between where there are like active debates and just like a lively conversation at a level where, yeah, like you said, I mean, it's some finances, sometimes you think of it as like a high-minded thing, or like you said, yeah, complicated debates about stuff. But yeah, no, it was a real like yeah, kind of that grassroots, that debates over the over Thanksgiving, that that type of level of discourse even before.
Yeah, and I think there was this hilarious, article I found in the New York Times. It was by the editorial board around the time that the Fed was created. And they were so irritated, like the editorial board was actively salty with the way that sort of the discourse in Washington was shaping up around who had founded the Fed, because they were like, we founded the Fed, like the people founded the Fed. We've been debating this in the pages of this newspaper, and this was a public creation, and this was our idea, basically. And I just thought that was so fascinating that, like, the what was even at the time, basically, the paper of record was saying, like, oh, hold up, Washington, D.C., you did not come up with this idea. This was like the popular discourse that gave us this. And I just thought, I mean, I think if you came at like a history of the Fed knowing sort of about sort of like the Jekyll Island mythology,
yep,
and the idea that, like, or not mythology, but, you know, like, yeah, that history, yeah, that portion of the history, and like you were like, oh, 1907 JP Morgan happened, and then, you know, these bankers went to Jekyll Island and came up with this prototype, and then it got turned in by Carter Glass into the what eventually became the Fed, which I think is very much the standard account, you miss how much like the politics of the era, the sort of aftermath of Williams Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold stuff, like all of that, like, morphed into what became the Fed. Like, this was very much like a long time in the making by the time it happened.
Yeah.
And then, like, remained really hotly debated up through the 1930s when we have the Great Depression, Mariner Eccles comes in onto the scene, and we get this really big reform of the Fed. And so I think that's sort of, you know, the back and forth, the publicly debated aspect of this, you just kind of miss in some of the standard histories. And so I thought that was something I tried to sort of imbue in this book, because I think it's just so interesting.
So, Gina, if I can ask the 10,000 foot follow up. So when I reviewed this book for American Banker, that was a big theme that I pulled out, you know, for my read too, is like, part, I kind of see this as a privilege that the public doesn't have to think about the Fed so much. You know, we're not, and you're going to see the problem with my question in 2 seconds. We're not in crisis every 7 years. But why haven't we sort of seen this renewed discussion? We have 2008, we have 2020, and now 2023. What's the reason that this hasn't really re-entered the public discourse in the way that it had in history? I'm asking you to speculate a little bit, but sort of why does that persist?
Yeah, so people who read this book will know that I worked really hard not to make opinions in this book, except I did have one. Like, I decided as a journalist, I was like allowed this one opinion, which I think is like news analytical versus like political opinion, which is that, like, we should be having discussions about the Fed again. Like, things have changed. Like, we did have like this like long period of like relative calm where it made sense for us not to think about the Fed. And now we like aren't in that moment anymore, because things have changed. The Fed is sort of in flux. It's changing in ways that are really important. And it's probably time for, like, in a democratic society where we want these institutions to be democratically accountable, we probably all need to be trying to understand, like, this needs to be part of our civic education, the way that the Supreme Court is part of your civic education. You kind of need a grasp on what the Fed does these days to be like sort of a you know, fully fledged member of civic society, I think. And so that's sort of like a central tenet of my entire book. But I don't actually have a good answer to your question. I do think part of it, I think it is true that we are not having these debates about the Fed, at least at a public popular level. I think part of the reason for that is because we have created sort of this sense in America that the Fed is just complicated to the point that normal people can't understand it. And I think that we have cloaked it in a lot of jargon, and that jargon even pervades a lot of the popular coverage of the institution. Yeah. And it can just be so impossible for people to sort of wrap their minds around. I actually have this kind of funny story, which I think I tell sometimes to like sort of illustrate the point here. But when I was young and I started covering the Fed, I was really young when I started covering the Fed. I was like 22. Like, I was not, I was like very, very early hire onto this beat. And so I was still at that like phase in life where like you're going to parties, you're meeting new people, etc. And you know, I lived in Washington DC, so naturally when you go to a party and meet a new person in Washington DC, they like try and triangulate whether they want to be friends with you by asking you where you went to college, what you do in your life, and then something that like tries to assess your political leanings. So those are sort of like, that's like the standard approach at a party in DC. And people would ask me like, you know, what do you do? And I'd be like, oh, I'm a journalist. And they'd be like, oh, that's so cool. What TV station? And I'd like disappoint them by being like, no, I'm not a TV journalist. I'm a print journalist. And they'd be like, oh, that's cool though. What do you cover? And if I like wanted to continue having a conversation with that person, I would say economics. And if I wanted to like stop the conversation in the tracks and like get away from it, I'd say the Federal Reserve. Because like if you said economics, they'd be like, oh, I loved econ in college, you know, like et cetera, et cetera. Okay. If you said I covered the Federal Reserve, it would just like stop a conversation in its tracks because everyone was like, too complicated for me. Don't want to talk about that. And like, this is amongst a crowd of people who are trying to assess you based on whether you went to a good enough college for them to hang out with, you know, like, so like we've already got some sample selection going on here. But I just thought that was really sort of elucidating about, I think, where we are as a society when it comes to the Federal Reserve. I think we've convinced everybody that this is such a complicated topic that you can't even touch it. And I don't actually think that's true, but I think that that is sort of the popular conception of monetary policy, central banking, et cetera.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, of who that benefits? Is it beneficial to the Fed to be kind of, because it gives a little bit of like kind of adds to the distance to the independence, or the kind of that myth of independence, that, or that idea, not myth necessarily, but that idea of independence, that it like kind of gives them an extra buffer to like away from critique? Or is it beneficial to financial institutions? Is it beneficial to the politicians themselves? I'm sure it's all of the above, but how do you think about like...
Yeah, so I kind of tried to go through a popular history of this in the book because I think it does arise from like two central places. I think the first is it is a legacy of the way the Fed thought about policy setting and ideal policy setting in the 80s and 90s. So I think during the Greenspan era, we saw this real idea that like if you brought Fed policymaking out to the light too much, if you put it under too much scrutiny, it would sort of break down the way the rest of Washington was breaking down. Like you were seeing some partisan strife. I mean, what we've had in the modern era, I feel like makes the strife of the 90s look like child's play, but it was a pretty contentious era politically. And so I think there was this idea that like, if you did that to monetary policy, you would take away the nimbleness, you would take away sort of like the deep and like important and incisive conversations that were happening about these policies, et cetera. And it was better to kind of leave this to the experts. And so I think that sort of sentiment around Federal Reserve policy really led to an era in which Greenspan, most obviously and most famously, but I think everyone in sort of Fed world thought that it was not just okay, but almost desirable to cloak this in a little bit of mystique. Like there was a great story in the Wall Street Journal after, I believe it was after the Fed first started releasing its statements. It was during one of the sort of, I might be getting that wrong, but it was during one of the transparency reforms during the 90s. And David Wessel and his co-author who were writing at the time wrote, and it almost sounded like a little sad, a little nostalgic, that the Wizard of Oz had been revealed to be just a man behind the curtain, like desperately yanking at the levers. And I thought that was, tells you something, right? Like there was this idea of like Fed mystique. And it was almost like embraced, I think. And then I think that really has started to shift. But I don't think we've fully gotten away from the jargon. And I don't think we've fully gotten away from this image that got in people's heads in the 90s and early 2000s that like the Fed is above and beyond us. You know, I think that was really sort of probably started during the Volcker era, but was really cemented during that period. I think the second part of it is I do think there's Fed watching is a huge industry. I covered the Fed at Bloomberg, so I was like intimately familiar with that particular industry. And I think that if you have a specialist industry where people make a lot of money off of understanding something better than everybody else, there's a lot of incentive to like keep that thing hard to understand. So the universe of people who are interpreting this stuff for the world tends to be the capital markets and sort of the broader apparatus surrounding capital markets. And they have every reason to keep talking about the dots and not explaining what the dots mean. You know, like there's like every reason not to explain this in simple language, I think. And so I do think it's sort of a 1-2 punch where like both legacy and sort of like incentives have lined up to keep this pretty complicated.
On the latter point, I think that's why we have ChatGPT now to decode the Fed for the public. I wanted to say, Gina, I mean, so some of the pushback, I guess, to the first point of, you know, let's drop the curtain is, you know, there's sort of this flip side where there's, for instance, with emergency measures, the more transparency you have, the more stigma there is. Releasing transcripts of the meetings has kind of led them to be scripted affairs. You know, what do you see as kind of that balance? How close are we to the right transparency spot? You know, because it's nice to, for instance, for people like us to read the transcripts. It would be nice to read real transcripts, you know, like what they were saying. So I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is clearly the case that transparency is not always costless. Like, I think that you can see historically that, actually, maybe you can't see it, but I think when you talk, when you're me or you guys, and you talk to a lot of former Fed officials, they will tell you that like things changed when they knew that those transcripts were going to start coming out. Like, it definitely changed the debate. As a journalist, I think it's like my solemn duty to inject into that like, maybe that's a good thing. Like, maybe whatever you were saying on these transcripts before, you like shouldn't be saying, frankly. Like, and I actually think there's some examples of that in like those early transcripts that they didn't know were going to be released. Like, I think that this is like a fact that has gotten lost to history, but there was an entire meeting held about like how to not release the transcripts that later got released in transcripts. And it's like, yeah, probably you shouldn't be sneaking around behind Congress's back and trying to figure out how to not release transcripts. Like, that seems bad for democratic accountability. And like, so like, I feel like at some level, like this is a public institution and they should be subject to that kind of transparency. So I think that like could be drawbacks, probably limitations to how serious those drawbacks are relative to the positives for the public of being able to see what these folks who are at the end of the day, elected or not, their representatives, like what they're up to. So I think that's one thing. I think the other argument you'll often hear about against transparency is it can actually be confusing and it can like lead to too much of a cacophony. I think that you will often hear that argument coming like specifically from Wall Street. And I think there's a reason you will hear that argument coming specifically from Wall Street, because like the cacophony means that like what the Fed is thinking about the world is out there in a public in a much more aggressive way than it previously was. Like, it used to be the case that if you had some sort of interaction with a Fed official that like conveyed something special to you, you know, whereas like, I think these days, like I say, as somebody who regularly interviews these Fed officials, like you don't get that much information that isn't already out there in the public because they're talking all the time. So I think it's been good from a sort of like getting the public aware of this world, and like probably less good from a being a specialized interest trying to know something interesting for the
so,
world.
So what is your view on how much the Fed should be doing? Because like we talk about transparency, like, okay, these Fed officials are out giving speeches, you know, to quote to the public, unquote, you know, but like, Nobody outside of our world is really reading those speeches, right? And you know, they'll read a press version, you know, to some degree. But how, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little dubious about the notion that like Fed officials should just get out there and talk more, not because of the cacophony, but I don't know. I'm dubious about the notion of communicating with the broader public, no matter how hard they may try. Do you think there's hope? Though, I mean, do they need to have a shift in communication strategy? I'm not sure another speaking event is really the way to go.
Yeah, so not to just continue telling you all of my stories, but I think this, again, this is an elucidated story that I have. So I was working on a story probably like 5 months ago about millennial men dropping out of the labor market. Not Fed-related, actually, really, except for in the sort of labor market sense. I talked to a guy for the story who stays at home. He's a stay-at-home dad most of the time. He does, like, gig work. And he lives in Texas, and he's like not your classic Fed watcher in any sense. Like, this is like a guy who writes a blog at home. And he watches like a ton of Fed speeches. Like he was very clued up on the Fed. And it was really interesting to me to chat with him because I was like, wow, this is fascinating to me. And what I thought was really interesting about him is he was basically like a like moderate level expert on Fed speak from home, just because he's keeping an eye on this stuff because he likes to day trade and it's like his hobby and he likes to write this blog. And it struck me, I was like, this wouldn't have been possible in an earlier era. Like, you would not have been able to do this from home in a world where the Fed is less communicative. And that would have been kind of unfair, right? Like, you probably would have still had the same aptitude and interest, but like in an earlier time, this would have been sort of only possible for somebody who had better Wall Street connections, more access to sort of the sort of specialty Fed speak newsletter apparatus that I think exists in this world. And so I don't think we've like fully democratized the Fed as a topic, but I think we have made progress. And I say we, meaning like sort of like the whole universe of Fed communications, like the actual Fed itself, the regional banks, the media. I think like some of the big media companies have really been trying to cover the Fed in sort of a demystifying way. I sit at the New York Times, so I have some first, and I am the Fed reporter here, so I have some firsthand insight into this topic. But like, I do think there has been some, obviously not created by me, but in general, I think there's been some progress in this area.
Yeah. Now, kind of jumping to back to kind of reforms, I want to get your thoughts as we're getting close to time here on at least two things that are happening right now. The first is the Freedom of Information Act, both the that would apply to the reserve banks, and then I'm interested in how what you think about the their new policies. How much of a change actually was it from somebody that has done many of those? And then on the second, just the SVB collapse and the reports that are coming out next in like 2 weeks about that, you know, those kind of there are these two things where the Fed will always try and get ahead of any actual kind of substantial changes, so they actually make ch internal changes. But on those two cents, on the supervision side and on the Freedom of Information Act kind of disclosure from the Reserve Bank side, what are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, on the FOIA thing, I actually don't think they're getting ahead of Congress that much. I think
Yeah,
they're
okay.
like under
It
some
wasn't
pretty
enough.
intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that like they have repeatedly been asked for things relative. This really ties back to the ethics scandal that happened last year and the year before. But they've been really facing a lot of requests for information from senators. And like, I think there's a point at which they can't just keep being like, no, we're not giving that to you. Like, and so I feel like that's a lot of why we're seeing some standardization across their FOIA practices. I think it's the devil is going to be in the details and how they actually carry out, which is always the case with FOIA. That's true across agencies that FOIA actually applies to, which it technically doesn't for the regional reserve banks. But like the devil's always in the details of how they choose to respond. Like you as a FOIA officer have a huge degree of discretion in which exemptions you choose to invoke when you're handing somebody back a FOIA, which anyone who's tried to use these will be familiar with. And then like me as a reporter or you as an interested party trying to get a FOIA out of them then has to be like, oh no, you shouldn't have used that exemption in this case and kick it back to them and get a lawyer to get involved, which is quite difficult. But like, especially if you don't know what information, they just blacked out. So it's very difficult to fight a FOIA exemption. So like so much of whether FOIAs work, whether they're an effective tool for holding the public accountable actually comes down to like how FOIA is used by the agency, like giving you that FOIA.
Interesting.
So
Interesting.
not to sound hugely pessimistic
Yeah,
about how
super
meaningful this
interesting.
regional reform is going to be. But I do think that like they have a huge degree of interpretation when it comes to these things. So we will see. TBD. I'm not about to cheerlead it until I see like actual FOIAs coming back with more information in them. But I think that's that. And then on the supervision stuff, man, I can't remember the last time I was this excited for a report. I don't know about you guys, but I am so interested to see what comes out in this. I'm interested on like six different levels, but the two main ones are like I want to know what happened, but then also I like want to know how much detail they're going to give us. I'm really intrigued because I feel like the early ethics reviews we actually haven't gotten that much detail was kind of. Not to sound like a grouchy journalist who always wants more details, but like I would have been happy with more. And I feel like I wonder if this is going to be a repeat of that. I wonder if it's going to be different. I'd love to hear what you two think.
Yeah. There's definitely
be happy
pressure on this thing than there was, and like there are other investigations that are like they're going to be competing against. So I know they, I would imagine they'll want to get ahead of those. But yeah, Stephen.
I was just going to say, I'll be happy if it's not like the CBDC report, which was delayed for months and months and then was basically like a Wikipedia article on CBDCs.
And it's going to be, it's going to be a big week. That's going to be a really big week. A lot on the time. Okay.
Because it's also a Fed meeting. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's going to be a very big jobs week. There's just so much going to be happening in that week. Okay, just last question. What has been the most fun about taking this book on the road?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or like the funnest a fun interaction that you've had with somebody, or just one final anecdote to close us off.
One final anecdote to close us off. You know, a lot of the events I've spoken at have been a lot of fun. I think maybe one of my favorite ones was I did a speaking event really early on at Politics and Prose.
Okay.
And we just had like a really engaged audience at that one. And it was so fun because we basically ended up like getting off the topic of the book entirely, but talking about like all these other various topics that we've covered pretty in depth at the Times. And it was fun because I like ended up just like collecting cards and then sending out links to all the stories we've done over the past 5 years afterwards.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, which was kind of, as a journalist, I'm like, I feel like the reason you write a book is so that people read your coverage, and it felt like I was like, this seems like it's headed in the right direction. So I think that was probably the most fun.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, congratulations. There's listeners, there are links in the show notes to send your gift, and I will include a link directly to where you can review on Amazon as well and
Thank
elsewhere.
You, Caleb.
You are very welcome. Stephen and Gina, thanks for coming on and doing this today.
Thank you.